My presentation, I called it Undoing the Researched, and I see it as a kind of call for something. And what I mean by undoing the researched is that a lot of known things seem to be tied up in frameworks of agreements of what knowledge is and what it is about and how it's achieved, and undoing the researched or untying or unclamping it from this framework would be something that I would call for. And I think the first part of my presentation will be kind of a complaining speech, because there's so many things that trouble me about the situation of knowledge at the moment. But hopefully in the second part, or as I go along, I'm heading towards some examples of what I'm talking about when I call for undoing the researched. Funnily, and I don't know if that really matters, but maybe it's important, just because it exists. In German, if you translate research, it actually has two meanings. There's Recherche, and then there's Forschung. And these two are two slightly different activities, where Recherche is basically looking up existing materials, where Forschung is based on experimentation, where you go into the unknown, where you go into places where there's at least one factor that is X. So in my practice, I've become increasingly uncomfortable with the implications of certain types of knowledge production and of research, and recently with what is now called artistic research. So as I said, first I want to complain a little, and then I'm coming to some examples. It's not that this discomfort is a new thing for me, but it has changed. That's what I discovered. I used to have this feeling of being some sort of imposter or fraud, and like constantly not scared, but somehow having this feeling of somebody might find out, you know, ask me for permission, why I carry out certain activities, or why I enter certain areas, like, you know, are you actually allowed in here? This kind of, you know, somebody finding out. And it's this mixture of uncomfort, but at the same time excitement when you do something half illegal, and there's a lot of interesting failures and misunderstandings and at the same time insights that result from this kind of, you know, slightly illegal activity that basically comes from, you know, not really having been taught research and just, you know, doing it for reasons of interest. And also, sometimes I felt this discomfort, especially when I was confronted with people who had actually been taught how to research in an academic way, that I was lacking the tools, that I was... you know, I was encountering people who were so elaborately and articulately talking about a subject, while I was struggling for words and even for structures, how to put my thoughts into, you know, into an order. And in the end, I always felt that this slight embarrassment that comes out of this, you know, stuttering and you know, struggling, helps for a sort of more open or a more open encounter or more open discussion, where, you know, you don't put your kind of education in front of you as a sort of protection shield. I sometimes felt that it's a little bit like my uncle, who's from the village, and he would, you know, in these posh Tehrani parties where people, you know, stand with their plates in their hands and have conversations, he would just sit on the floor and eat with his hands and embarrass everybody. And I felt that he somehow grounded the pretentiousness and you know, people hiding behind their plates, and allowed for a kind of multiplicity of perspectives and of a potential, you know, what the situation could possibly be other than representational. His question was, for me, was basically a question mark in that setting. And I found that my own failures in order to, you know, in meeting the standards or the demands of research, and also of its presentation, created these question marks also for myself, but also for the context that I engaged in. And that's why I would somehow call it, or like to call it, a productive discomfort. So what's my discomfort now? This topic of this conference, artistic research. And I was like, oh, okay, so now it has a name, officially, you know. And what does that mean, you know, when things suddenly have a name, when they're given a name? There's a couple of things, you know. Firstly, the awkwardness is gone. And you don't need to vindicate anymore, you know, why you're there and what you're doing. Actually, you're invited to eat on the floor in conferences, because you add the spice to, you know, the kind of academic dryness. Or also, you know, there's also this tendency of like, you know, fuck this, I'm going to get myself an artist PhD, you know. So there's these different moves in there that make me wonder, you know, the kind of mechanisms that are let loose when you give something an official name and how one wants to deal with that. I have a simple example from my Meisterschüler presentation, which is like the German equivalent of a master's. It's kind of dying out now since bachelor and master. So I had these jury members inspecting my presentation, and I had done a presentation of pacemakers, and they had been listening to me for 15 hours explaining why, you know, when and how pacemakers are implanted in the body. And one of them, while turning away, just like really dismissively and also self-assuringly commented, pseudo-scientific crap. And the other were like, yeah. And it was really like, I was like, yes. It was kind of a victory for me, because I didn't really want this gang of old men who have the lifetime permission to tell students what's art and what isn't, to affirm with what I had to say. I just wanted to share this experience with them, and I wanted to talk to their hearts in this very direct and technical way, you know, explaining pacemakers. I think they got the message. And if I imagine the same presentation happening now, you know, this is like, what, 12 to 14 years back, the jury members today, you know, might simply ask, is this a student of artistic research, or is this multimedia, I would say, like, artistic research, and they would say, thank you, no questions, you know, because it's clear, you know, it's artistic research, of course. What else do you need to know about the presentation? So not only would I have been deprived of my victory, I, on the contrary, might have also fallen into the trap of, like, dealing with the insecurity of the situation, because, of course, it's, you know, it's this discomfort of, like, you know, explaining to these guys something that you yourself are not taught to explain, and you're like, and if you find a way out, you would take it. And of course, yeah, artistic research. And looking at the art academies today, I somehow worry about, you know, seeing a generation of art students who think that they need to pull out some quote of Bourdieu or Agamben or you know, show what they found on Wikipedia in order to kind of reinforce their work or their project, what it's called now, with this gesture of research. You know, I've done research about this. And I'm not sure what that's actually doing, and whether that this application of research as a sort of necessary ingredient of artworks today is actually what produces, or what you know, research in the sense of an experiment is about. So maybe I just quickly go through a couple of like developments of my own, of the way that my own research has changed, because it's gone through some changes. So first, when I started, I thought that the purpose of research was to kind of bridge the gap of, you know, this alienation that is created through an elitist and exclusive knowledge production in science, and to kind of abuse the art space to make science accessible. I think the Pacemaker project was part of that phase. And soon I learned that, you know, this is precisely what the industries around biotech science and technosciences want artists to do, you know, to help culturalizing, help popularizing science and embed it in society and in culture. In order to make grounds also for their products and promote their activities. So I stopped that. And I started actually researching the implementation of power structures through representation. For example, art creating an image, a cultural or human or popular image for the industrial complexes. Eventually, this led into research that is more generally about representation and the image as one of the pillars of the installation, but also of the distribution of power. So here we have an example, you know, an activity that was lacking a definition and now has a name, artistic research. An image, you know, you can put it on the wall. An image that, in my opinion, calls for defacement. Michael Taussig says that only the hysteric and the revolutionary asks, why is this the name of the event? And in a constant gesture of renaming, kind of defaces the given name and the authority behind the name, or the authority behind, you know, the power of definition of giving names to events or to things. And I'm suggesting a hysterical approach here and ask, why is this the name of the event? And I want to show you, I want to show you a couple of excerpts of a film about Sun Ra, but I will show a couple of excerpts later. For now, just this one.
I have many names. Names of mystery. Names of splendor.
Names of splendor.
Names of shame.
Names of shame.
I have many names.
I don't want to dispute that there's no genuine curiosity or interest in artistic or in the practice of artistic research. I just see an increasing use of formulas and ready-made bites of researched material, and It's a kind of self-deceptive way to get to results, especially when one is under time pressure, which one most of the times is. And there's nothing more satisfying than, you know, having a question and simply looking it up on Wikipedia and feeling to know a little bit more. But knowledge can be a trap, and I somehow feel that we might be just reenacting the discovery of known things every day in the millions. So maybe it is necessary that we render some things unknown in order to get an idea what research is about, other than looking it up on Wikipedia. Sandra says knowledge is laughable when attributed to a human being. He speaks of unknown things, of impossible things, of potential things. I think he was a very interesting researcher in his own way. But back to some pressing questions and some problems that I observe. We are in this phase of a sort of project culture. Artistic research is part of that. I'm doing a project on so and so at the moment. So I just want to picture two cases. Like, you know, an artist invited to a residency in a place that is favorably a difficult place, Palestine or Cyprus or, you know, for a research period. And they're supposed to do some research and then come up with a project, with a work that is ideally site-specific, contextual, and thematically related to the history of the place or whatever. And it's like 3 months' time for the project. Case two, an artist is doing three different projects in 2 years. One is about a Palestinian refugee camp in Lebanon. One is about street vendors in Mexico City. And one is about glue-sniffing children in Istanbul. And somehow he has to tie this all together under a more general theme, which he then calls informal structures, so that he can explain what his work is about more in general. And I really asked myself, you know, how can one research as a visitor in a place for a period of 3 months without using preset formulas? Or how can one do it at all? I'm really not sure. And what kind of responsibility comes with research and also with the people that one involves in it? And what happens to the insights gathered in these research phases after the project is over? What do we actually learn and what do we do with it? And then also, who do we address? You know, who can actually cope with all this this content that we're constantly producing, locally and also globally? So I think I'm going to skip this part and really go to this this question of how can, you know, if it's about untying the known things out of this framework of agreements, how can we do that, and how can we have this this experimentation also in a collective way, you know, something that we do together, not something doing for us, as in academia often suggested. So there's a series of artists who have shown ways of really diving into this collective experience of experiment that I see as an interesting suggestion of ways of untying or of, you know, of rendering things unknown that we thought we know about. And one of them is actually Sun Ra, whose methodology, if one wants to say that, is his astro black philosophy, which is basically saying that he comes from outer space as an origin, opposed to you know, as a black person coming from Africa, having been a slave and being part of that history. He's kind of escaping this essentialist history by saying, no, I'm actually from outer space. And all I do, you know, my music and everything that I say is all from outer space. I'm not from this planet. So his music, outer space for him is the unknown region, and his music is located precisely there, and he invites the listener to come there. And I want to show you two more excerpts from this video, which is called A Joyful Noise. It's a documentary on Sun Ra.
I write, tell this story. A story that humanity needs to know about. In my music, I speak of unknown things, impossible things.
The second example is John Cage, where he introduces chants as the method of introducing the unknown, and creates compositions that take himself, but also the audience, to places that you can't possibly know before because there's chants involved. At the same time, he uses a set of guidelines, as Sun Ra does as well. You know, for Sun Ra, discipline and precision are, you know, two very important factors. I want to play one piece by John Cage by the name Radio Music. It's from 1956. And it's a setup with eight players, and each of them has a radio, and it's composed using chance operations. The composition is quite set out, you know, changing frequencies in that moment, and then lines indicate silences, which are then expressed by maximum amplitude. And also the number of silences is defined in every part. I'm not going to play the whole piece because I think we don't have so much time, but at least a part of it.
Sono le 22:30.
And the piece is 4:33. I just played 2 minutes of it, but you probably know it's like it's going through the frequency, different frequencies of the radio bandwidth. And I mean, you have to imagine this is 1956, and you know, to call a piece Radio Music and to deliver this is also quite funny. Then the next person that I want to introduce is Alvin Lussier, where he finds this uncontrollable or this unknown factor in the interaction between sound and space, where he uses the physical laws of acoustics that he kind of sends his voice into space and then lets the space do something completely different with it. And I want to play a part of, again, just an excerpt because it's 15 minutes long, of his piece, I'm Sitting in a Room, which is from 1968. It's the original recording. It's the sound is the crackles that you hear, it's because of the record. It's a recording from a record, and it's not very loud. But the setup is he has two tape recorders. He records his voice, and then he plays his voice on one tape recorder while recording it with the other. So it's always his voice travels through space and then is re-recorded back onto the other recorder. And then this process is repeated until nothing than the actual frequencies of the space are left. So it basically the content of his speech is filtered out. I will skip through passages of it.
I am sitting in a room different from the one you are in now. I am recording the sound of my speaking voice, and I am going to play it back into the room.
The last example, and that's also the last thing for this presentation, is a seminar. I want to show you an excerpt. A seminar that was scheduled to take place at the auditorium of the New Museum in New York, 2008. I rescheduled it to take place at the Whole Foods supermarket around the corner from the New Museum. Whole Foods, I don't know if you are familiar with it. It's an organic food store that started as a grassroots store and became this major corporation now that kind of buys up all the organic stores in the U.S., but also now they started abroad, and they're really gigantuous. Like, also the actual supermarket is like, it's quite overwhelming. The attempt to confuse these two known spaces and also the kind of known activities that you are used to do in each of them, and to shift them to another location, kind of rendered both unknown and made some space for overwriting or defacing the kind of activities that one normally associates with that spaces. So here you see Avery Gordon, who I invited for one of the days of the seminars. The setup, I have to say, because we didn't get permission to film at Whole Foods, my friend Angela Anderson put a spy camera on her shoulder, and she's filming just with this little spy camera. That's why the quality is kind of low. The amazing thing is that we're kind of invisible. Nobody takes notice of us. And at the same time, I don't know if the video transports it so well, but it was for me, it was an experience that I will never enter a Whole Foods supermarket again thinking that I need to buy something there. It's like this moment when we walked through the counter where you pay usually, after having all this conversation, it's like this whole activity of buying something and paying, it was totally overwritten by this conversation. And I thought it was also in parts because Avery here is reading from a manifesto or a declaration from 1649 from a group called the Diggers that were active in England at that time, and she will read it. I don't know how much time we have. This is 6 minutes. I would play it, and we can stop whenever the time runs out.
This one was written in 1649. It's called A Declaration from the Poor Oppressed People of England, directed to all that call themselves are called Lords of Manners. And it
said, this nation.
Through this nation, environmentalism that links, a critique of private property and consumerism and the god of money. Mm-hmm.